We're going to continue talking about evidences for the existence of God. We're going to get into more detail into the specific types of arguments that can be presented to prove within a reasonable doubt beyond a reasonable doubt, let me say, the existence of God. And the reason I say that is because Paul tells us in Romans chapter 1, there in verses 18 through 20. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. And so that's why I say beyond a reasonable doubt, because God has clearly and plainly revealed himself to man in so many different ways. I can recall a conversation that I had with my son as we were looking up and we saw a wing of Canadian geese flying overhead in perfect V formation. And another one that was lifting off and it was forming into a V formation. And the fact that is not an accidental thing that they do. They do that because it improves their efficiency in flying. The point man, if you will, encounters the greatest amount of drag and resistance. And then the ones after him, a little bit less, and a little bit less, and a little bit less. And so that the one who's flying in the very back, he's exerting considerably less effort to fly than the person, or the bird in this case, in the front. And so we look at that and we ask ourselves, you know, how did they come up with that scheme of things? I mean, did a group of geese chatter away and honk at each other and say, you know, this is what we need to do because it was something that was been built into them. They do that uniformly, that particular breed. Other birds migrate in different fashions. Some, we'll talk about that more in a little bit later, but some use one standard to guide their navigation. Another species uses a different type of standard or rule, if you will, to guide their navigation. And some scientists even still don't know how it is that they navigate the distances that they do to the accurate degree that they do. So all of these things, countless other examples could be given, point to the existence of God and as the Holy Spirit guided Paul to write so that they are without excuse. Yes, Bill.
Exactly what I was going to say. You're talking about one example there, mm-hmm. but there's hundreds and thousands and, I don't know, many creatures as there are made that you can see the amazing planning and purpose in their design. And, and I think that's a lot of what God is talking about in the Scripture in Romans when it says, you know, it's obvious to people. Should be mm-hmm. Romans 1. Should right. be apparent. And those things should make it apparent to everyone. Yeah.
So, this kind of thinking and this particular line of thought that there is design in the world around us that defies a random idea that shows purpose, it shows intent, it shows wisdom, and all of these things point to something more than just a random collection of molecules bumping into each other in a certain way over eons of time and coming up with the right answer. So we'll get on to that. So this argument is what is called the teleological argument. The idea being that there is a kind of a design or purpose, especially in nature, not only in the nature as we observe it on Earth, but as we observe it even through our solar system. And as astronomers have looked into the universe more and more, they see that this planet that we live on is indeed in a cosmic sweet spot, if you will, to sustain life and to have what we have here before us. It's truly beyond amazing and remarkable. It's virtually miraculous that we are where we are, and we have the planet that we do, and so on. So this argument, as we put it forth, is the idea that the universe evinces purposeful design. Therefore, design comes from a designer. And we would talk, we'll talk more about that a little bit later. The universe does evince purposeful design. We've been talking about that a little bit already. And thus the universe must have had a designer. And so this is the approach that's being taken with the teleological argument. Design implies a designer. The point of contention with the atheist is whether there is evidence of design in nature adequate to draw this conclusion. And they're going to say, no, there isn't. The things that we see and that we attribute design to are things that are purpose that are explainable by these processes of evolution and of the Big Bang and so on. And so, you know, they don't deny that the universe shows signs of design. They simply deny that this is sufficient for one to conclude that there is a designer behind it all. Have we ever seen any example of something that is designed that does not have a designer? Can anyone point to something? Other than, I should have qualified that, other than in the natural realm. Have you ever encountered for example, a random piece of art or architecture or whatever it might be that was just thrown together and lo and behold, it's just got this beautiful design to it? Yeah, Bill?
Yeah, well, at the ocean, I think it was last week, for a couple days there, and you can see these ripples on the sand that were beautiful. It was amazing. And it was obvious that it was natural. You know what I'm saying? If there had been the same thing with a Mona Lisa,
right?
You know, the wind caused the Mona Lisa to take shape, that would be a whole different thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be obvious to me that it's a whole different thing. That showed, that windswept sand, it was obvious because I knew how it happened. It wasn't designed, even though it was beautiful, because it was just wind blowing.
Right.
And that was random. But the picture, if there had been a beautiful Mona Lisa or whatever, wind blew the sand up into a statue of a person with a baseball bat.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Or little Oliver this morning spilled his Cheerios on the floor, and they look down, and there's a perfect representation of a world map. I mean, every continent and everything, and the milk is in the place where the oceans. I mean, that doesn't happen, does it?
That's the kind of
everybody. Right.
Understand.
Sure. Okay, so we're going on from there. So let's consider as an example, first of all, our solar system and Earth. Now, here's some things just very quickly, and you can certainly get more information on these points, but these are general things that you can point to. Now, the fact that the Earth is located exactly the correct distance from the sun to receive the proper amount of heat and radiation to sustain life as we know it. Now, if we were on Mercury, it would be far too hot. You know, life would never have formed there because it's so close in proximity to the sun, and it gets so much of the harmful radiant effects of the sun. And same thing with Venus. It's a gaseous planet, that we know not too much about, but Again, it's not the right type of location for life. Here we are in the third position from the sun, about 240,000, I'm sorry, more than that, 93 point something million miles from the sun. We get just the right, you know, right amount of radiation and heat and to sustain life. It's like finding the sweet spot in a room that's heated by a portable heater, you know. You don't want to sit too close to the portable heater because then you're sweating, and you don't want to be in the opposite end of the house because then you don't feel it at all. So you find the right distance and, you know, things feel good that way. Now, there's a typo here, and that's my fault. We're talking about the moon positioned 240,000 miles from the moon, that should be. If the moon were closer by a fifth, the tides would be enormous. Bill talked about going to the beach. He'd have been witnessing 35 to 50 foot tidal waves on a regular basis. And of course, that simply would not function for us as we know life on this planet to have that kind of massive movement of the water on a regular basis. The Earth is tilted on its axis at a precise 23.5 degrees. If it were just straight up and down in its respect to the axis of the sun, much of the Earth's water would accumulate around the two poles, and it would leave vast deserts in its place. So the position of the Earth's tilt and axis have an effect on how the oceans are distributed around the globe. And we look at this, the atmosphere is just right for our protection. If it were thinner, we would have meteorites that could come in and cause worldwide devastation. We would also get certain types of radiation from the sun that would prevent life from being as prolific as it is here. And there's just so many different things we could get into there. The moisture in our atmosphere, which is the result of evaporation off the oceans and off of even the forests of the world, provides enough of a layer over the earth to screen out much of the harmful radiant effects of the sun. Furthermore, the oceans provide a huge reservoir of moisture. I also found it just fascinating to me as we were flying up to Alaska one time, and some of you are certainly more familiar with this than I am, some of you having even lived there. But as we were flying up, you could see these glaciers that were all feeding down into the ocean. And you know, these glaciers are actually the storage place for fresh water on the planet. And they constantly replenish the ocean with fresh water. Sam, you had your hand up. Okay.
Design,
right.
In the subject of the earth and its position and stuff like that, is where you see that things go against nature sometimes. Where if you have the wind blowing on the sand, you're like, yeah, I can see that naturally happen, right? But if somebody writes their name and you disturb the natural what was happening and influence it to show something that you did it, right? And so the same with the earth as far as its protection is. There's some things about the planet that the scientists are that this goes against physics. This shouldn't have been able to happen,
right.
As far as we know how things naturally happen in the universe. Is that the Earth rotates one way, but its core is made out of something and it rotates the opposite way.
Right.
And so they're like, okay, how could that have happened if something's spinning one way and the outside's spinning the other way? And so on top of that, they find out that it has a very, very important function that makes this planet special is that it puts out an electromagnetic shield,
right?
That there's certain parts of the sun's rays that would get through our ozone if we did not have that shield. And so that's kind of like huge pictures of, like, the scientists would say, I can see this naturally happening. But when they really see design, they're like, this couldn't naturally happen. It had to be influenced.
It would be like...
Again, using that illustration of the sand on the seashore, you know, your mom and dad walking out there onto the beach, and there, instead of just little ripples in the sand, is complete collection of Shakespeare's sonnets, you know, all blown into the sand. You know, that no one would conclude that's what happens when the wind blows from a storm. They'd know somebody was out there, you know, doing that for whatever purpose in the sand. And so that's the kind of thing that just doesn't follow as being true. Regarding the oceans, the water heats and cools at a much slower rate than a solid land mass and provides a sort of natural heating and air conditioning system for the land areas. And we here in the Northwest certainly get the benefit of that because our weather would be much more severe if we weren't so close to the oceans and to a major body of water, the Puget Sound. And even on the east side of the mountains, the winters and summers and so on are much more extreme, aren't they? Because you don't have the cooling effect of the ocean. But overall, these bodies of water, the oceans, act to moderate the climates of the earth. Human and animals inhale oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide. Plants take in carbon dioxide and give off oxygen. 90% of our oxygen comes from microscopic plants in the seas. If our oceans were appreciably smaller, we soon would be out of air to breathe. So there again, you don't typically think of that. I mean, you think of the ocean, you think of drowning, don't you? But if we didn't have the oceans, everyone on the land would literally asphyxiate because there wouldn't be enough oxygen produced by these microscopic animals. I'm trying to think of the name of those animals, and it escapes me at the moment. Somebody else does. Plankton. It's actually the skeletons of these oceanic animals. Anyway, I'll get to it. Okay. Any other comments or observations? Yeah, Gary.
I would think when we have these studies, it's interesting. But even from when I was a child, I just don't understand why anybody would say that there's not a God. The fact that, here, I'm going to touch a name. He feels that, how can he say, oh, that was just a phenomenon. I'll never understand. And you just keep on talking about these things, what warns us, but there's God's fingerprint. There's God's fingerprint. The way we breathe, the formation of the Grand Canyon, God's fingerprints are all around us. And you would have to literally have to close your eyes and your ears and say la 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 to not see God's fingerprint. God's fingerprints.
Very good. Okay, so that's
what we're asking is, how can we believe that this is all an accident? Can a person reasonably be expected to believe that these exacting requirements for life as we know it have been met just by accident? There's a number of different types of examples that could be used, some of which we've already mentioned. But one of the ideas that is put forward is that the existence of the earth is, and the life on the earth is a result of a very fine-tuned arrangement with so many different factors all, you know, working into that. It would be like having a radio in front of you that has 1,000 dials on it. Oops. See, I can't even operate a microphone. But that has 1,000 dials on it, you know, and each one has to be set within a hair's breadth just to get a signal from somewhere. So we see all of the exacting things that are just precisely the way that they're supposed to be. And here's a few examples. The earth is exactly the right distance from the sun, as we talked about, the right distance from the moon, exactly the right diameter, exactly the right atmospheric pressure, the right tilt, the right amount of oceanic water, exactly the right weight and mass and so on. In fact, some have pointed out that the thickness of the Earth's crust is such that if it were thicker or thinner, again, life could not be sustained. And so it's just difficult for a reasonable person to comprehend how other people can be blind to these things. A British evolutionist named Sir Frederick Hoyle has stressed the insurmountable problem with such thinking. This man's an evolutionist. So he's not, you know, this is what he is admitting. The chance that higher forms have emerged in this way is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from the materials therein. We've all heard that illustration before, but it's still a good one to use. That, you know, just blowing through the junkyard, all of a sudden, the other end of the storm, instead of ruin and chaos, we have a perfectly assembled Boeing 747. The probability of life originating at random is utterly minuscule as to make the random concept absurd. It becomes sensible to think that the favorable properties of physics on which life depends are in every respect deliberate. It is therefore almost inevitable that our own measure of intelligence must reflect in a valid way the higher intelligences, even to the extreme idealized limit of God. So, you know, here again we have somebody who's recognized as an authority on evolution, and yet in his own reflection he is pointing out that the random idea put forth by evolution just doesn't make sense. All right, and finally, on this particular point, animal instinct. We could look at many examples in the area of animal instinctual behavior. Salmon return to the place where they were born after many years at sea, even to the extent that not too many years ago there was a fish hatchery over in, I believe, in Issaquah, where they discovered one day that the drains there were filled with salmon that had come back up the river and actually gone up the drain and were trying to knock the grate off of the floor of the hatchery so they could return to the place they were born. Their instinct was that finely tuned, not just the river or certain area in the river, but even to that specific place. And this was something that was in a story in the news. Eels. I know that they're all our favorite animals, eels. From Europe and America migrate to Bermuda, where they breed and die. And their young then return to either Europe or America, depending on the parents' origin. And, you know, who told them where they were, you know, where their parents were from. But they've seen that's what it is. Migration pattern of birds have been a mystery to ornithologists for many years, how and why they migrate in the precise ways that they do is something that science doesn't completely understand. Any other examples that you all can think of or have heard or read about? Yeah, Teresa?
Why it was designed to dwell in the desert, that it was all, that's its habitat, help, you know, the eyelashes shield the sand from blowing in its eyes. And it was very fascinating. I mean, there was a whole list of every aspect of this creature and why it was a desert dweller. And yet we as humans tend to take these animals out of their habitat and expect them to function.
Yeah.
You know, in other ways. But I just found it very fascinating because, you know, we think of the human body and how fascinating it is that it heals itself and all those things, but you don't often think of animals so much and how God created them to dwell where they dwell and be efficient.
Yeah,
and I
saw a documentary,
nature film, similar to what you're speaking of, that talked about beavers, you know, and the even to the coating on their fur and all of that. That's just extremely... Yes, Bill. Engineers go so many times to get ideas about how to, you know, maybe build a new structure or how to design a certain feature or function in something. They'll go to nature. You know, they'll look at the structure of a tree and they'll say, hey, that's interesting. You know, one main branch supports smaller branches and smaller branches and creates this massive structure that can support, you know, things way out here in extremities. Without, you know, pillars supporting it, you know, they look at different things and see answers to problems that are being encountered. And in flight, I know it's true with regards to birds that you know, aeronautical engineers have used characteristics of birds. Go ahead.
I've got a number of favorites, but maybe just one or two. Uh-huh. I think it's great sharing these favorites because there are some amazing things. One thing that I think of is the circulatory system, the clotting system in your
You're
going to
jump
in. Oh, okay. Well, how about I get to the, you talk about the nudibranch?
What?
Okay, I'll leave you the blood one. The nudibranchs.
No.
Sea slugs. Beautiful no. Sea slugs. I want to talk about one nudibranch.
Okay.
Is that there's this particular nudibranch. And there's this one particular nudibranch, this beautiful sea slug that floats around.
Yeah. Well,
that part of its meal or part of its food it eats is are spiny urchins.
Okay.
Well, small spiny urchins. And what it will do is it will consume this urchin and devour the flesh and everything. But the needles that are on the urchin, it will actually pull into its system and push out its back and becomes its defense.
Oh, wow.
On the back of this nudibranch. Hmm. So you've got to figure out how did that evolve? How did that symbiotic system evolve?
Mm-hmm.
Like that? It couldn't have. It was made that way.
Right.
Very interesting. You know, symbiotic system was designed that way. It couldn't have happened that way. I mean, how would the nudibranch have evolved it if each urchin hadn't evolved yet, or the other way around? It's like it just blows your mind to think that could come around naturally.
There's this
documentary on flight that. Highlights the relationship between this certain bee or wasp, I'm not sure which, but and this very specific flower. And the thing is that, you know, the flower sends out its attractant, and it attracts this specific bee who uniquely fits into a certain structure of the flower. You know, there's a certain width there, and it can fit inside of there. And when it gets inside of there, it inevitably steps on this little sensor thing inside the flower, and this little arm hanging down comes up specifically and puts pollen on the back of this bee. And, of course, the flower lets the bee drink and get all that it wants from that, and then the bee flies off. Now, I looked at that and I asked myself, okay, which one came first? This bee that's looking for a certain flower that doesn't exist yet? Or the flower that languishes and can't reproduce for generations and generations until the bee gets its act together and evolves, you know? I mean, they had to exist at the same time because they so undeniably, absolutely depend on each other. And so the idea of each one evolving with certain things that are specific to another created creature or another creature, it just doesn't fit into the evolutionary mindset. So, any other comments or observations? Okay. The human body is another area that we all can look to as examples of design and intelligence being projected by the design of the human body. Even the psalmist David, and we're familiar with what he said in Psalm 139, verse 14. We haven't been quoting very many scriptures in this particular class, but we're talking about things out primarily outside of the Bible that point to God's existence. And the psalmist here says, "I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works. My soul knows it very well." And that's a good place to start a conversation, that the Bible points to these evidences even within the human body. Augustine observed, "Men go abroad to wonder at the height of mountains, at the huge waves of the sea, at the long course of the rivers, at the vast compass of the ocean and the circular motion of the stars, and they pass by themselves without wondering." And there's so many different things. Even evolutionists have been forced to recognize George Gaylord Simpson, quoting him, "In man, one finds the most highly endowed organization of matter that has yet appeared on the earth." And we could add, what is more highly organized even in the universe itself than man and his own body? And Guinness had this to say, "When you come right down to it, the most incredible creation in the universe is you, with your fantastic senses and strengths, your ingenious defenses system, and mental capabilities so great you can never use them to the fullest. Your body is a structural masterpiece more amazing than science fiction." And you know, that would be amazing if there was just one human being, wouldn't it? There was just one human being. When we're talking about a body, a physical body, and we'll talk about this more in a moment, that can reproduce itself. We see, you know, so many different examples that point to a great designer, whether it's your eyes, for example. The eye doesn't only appear in one species of animals, it appears in myriad different types of animals. And each one, the eye is different in the way it receives light, in the way in which it moves, in the way in which it's positioned on the body or the head of the animal that that it's on. We have two forward-looking eyes. You know, so many animals have eyes that are on each side of their body. Whales, for example, even though their eye is positioned on the side of their head, they can see all the way back to their fluke without bending around to do so. they have that range and that wide breadth of scope in their vision. Other animals, like a fly, have what they call a complex eye, all these just little tiny, tiny lenses that can see everything at every angle, and that's why you'll never be able to sneak up on a fly. He's got you out eyeballed. He can see you before you know you're coming. So on. So, you know, there's just, again, we could go on and on with this, but we have a respiratory system in the human body that consists of two lungs, a heart, you know, and so on, that work together to circulate blood through our system, to take in oxygen and expel carbon dioxide. And again, all of this works together, completely functioning as God intended in the vast majority of cases. And Bill, what you got going back there?
The vaults are interesting too.
Yeah.
They're strong as steel. And yet when they break, they can repair themselves. Mm-hmm. And the repair would be stronger than the vault originally was. How did that happen over time? Mm-hmm. We had to be creative with that.
Yeah, I mean, the bone structure
of a human body is so complex that you don't just have an orthopedist who is, does your whole body. One guy works on the knee. Another guy works on your hand. You know, maybe another guy knows your foot. All of these things are just, you know, complex and so fully involved that, you know, the attention of an individual, even very highly trained, can be on that one aspect of the human body, the hand and all the bones in the hand and the tendons and everything, and the ability of the hand to grasp or to move, like in the playing of a piano or some other intricate function, is just phenomenal to consider. Cell structure and function of the human body, composed of over 30 different kinds of cells, totaling approximately 100 trillion cells in an average adult. Boy, whoever typed this needs to really get his act together. Three major components: cell membrane, cytoplasm, and the nucleus, genetic material and control center in the nucleus. Again, these things are all present and hold together the cell. In the cytoplasm, over 20 different chemical reactions occurring at any one time. It's like having a miniaturized body within your body, all of these different cells. Each cell contains five major components for communication, waste disposal, nutrition, repair, and reproduction of the cell. And he goes on to talk about DNA. DNA is, to me, this is one of those proofs to me that is the clincher. You know, I mean, how anyone can understand that how DNA functions in the human body and in all animals, for that matter. DNA stands for deribonucleic acid. It's a supermolecule carrying coded information for the replication of the cell. It's a super long string of code. And you've all seen the double helix design linked in the center. Stores coded information in a chemical format and then uses a biological agent, RNA, to decode and activate it. So not only do we have this coded information, we have the key to reading it within each and every one of us. DNA information in one human cell would fill a 1,000 volume set of encyclopedias, 600 pages each. And so that's just a very basic overview. All the specific information needed to produce the entire human population, 7 billion people, could be placed into a space of about 1/8 of a square inch. So you talk about, you know, computers and the data and how small, you know, memory has gotten in a computer and what it can do and how fast it can function. We don't have anything on God. Here. I can see your hand creeping up. Yeah.
Can you go back one slide?
Can I go back one slide?
Yeah, I was thinking this before you got into the DNA, that last, okay. last point there, each cell contains five major components.
Yeah.
Communication, waste and disposal, nutrition, repair, reproduction. But think about it, right? Before you had even one creature, right? Mm-hmm. One animal, one plant, anything at all.
Right.
You'd have to have something like that already built and already come together before you even had a chicken animal. And so you've got all that construction to do in the very building blocks. It'd be like before you had a building, you'd have to have a 2x4 first.
Right. And you have a tree.
And it's not just a 2x4 or a tree. It's all these complicated, and these mechanisms would have to be working and functioning. And without an animal, to what end would it be evolving to? It doesn't know what it's going to be an animal one day, and so I've got to evolve myself. It has to be designed and put in place so that when it was, so that it could, and it was designed, of course, at the time, whatever God designed it to, so that it was ready for him to create.
Imagine if you had a field.
And out of nowhere, somebody just came in and cleared off the field in a random, fashion, just cleared it off so that the ground was open and free. And then along wandering through the woods came a group of foundation layers, and they said, hey, let's lay a foundation here. And they laid that foundation and then went on their way. And then you had us, this strange, strange tribe of individuals called carpenters who came along and said, let's put a door here and let's put a window there. And none of them had any plans or any idea that there was going to be something. And then there's these guys that came along that were drywall. You could take it on and on. Obviously, before you begin the building of a building, you have the plan for the finished building, don't you? And you have somebody who oversees it all, somebody of incredible wisdom and knowledge, and they call them general contractors, right? I'm just kidding. That's what they call them, general contractors and architects and so on, who put this all together in their mind and have the plan set forth. And if you look at the human body, how can we but conclude that before it all came together, somebody planned and put it together in his mind, and hence what David wrote in Psalm 139, I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Was an expression of his true appreciation for God's wisdom. Good point. Okay, so going on then, concerning this DNA, the supermolecule could not have happened by blind chance. Again, we're talking about this, it's extremely long. It took a group of scientists years and years and years just to map out the human DNA and the sequencing of it, because it had to be precisely the right way. And to think that this kind of a code could come about just randomly, this fellow E.H. Andrews said, it is not possible for a code of any kind to arise by chance or accident. A code is the work of an intelligent mind. Even the cleverest dog or chimpanzee could not work out a code of any kind. It is obvious then that chance cannot do it. This could no more have been the work of a chance or accident than could the Moonlight Sonata be played by mice running up and down the keyboard of my piano. And there's so many different examples that express the absurdity of it all. And so codes do not arise from chaos. The idea that we would have intelligent communication involved in something that is just absolutely random. Now, talking about blood clotting, and this is what Bill was referring to earlier. So the idea of blood clotting, and there's a book called Darwin's Black Box, The Biochemical Challenge to Evolution, written by a scientist named Michael Behe. So there's this concept that's called irreducible complexity. And the most common example of that is the mousetrap. So what are the parts of a mousetrap? Kind you could go right now over to McClendon's and buy. What are the parts of a mousetrap?
A base.
Has a base. Okay. What else?
Germs.
a spring. Okay. Anything else? Little hammer. It's a clip that falls over. And anything else? Huh? A little bait holder, and that acts as a catch, doesn't it, for the hole? So all of these things are necessary for a mouse trap to function. What if I just said, well, let's not have a base. Let's just put these parts out there. And then hopefully when the mouse runs over them, it'll kill the mouse, right? No, the base holds it all together, doesn't it? And then the spring and the hammer and the, trip lever and all of that all work together. And you know, people have worked on this and looked at it and say, how can we reduce this complexity here? You can't. And if you take any part away, that it just becomes a random collection of junk. It doesn't function in any way. So this is what the case is with blood clotting. That there's this complex chain, a process that requires every step of the chain to function for successful clotting of our blood. And we could go into that more in depth. I would just refer you to this book that we have listed here, or you could look it up online even, what's involved in blood clotting. So how could parts of such a chain process evolve all at the same time in just the right order? In other words, again, we're talking about randomness being the source for this thing and not any kind of design. Animals would have become extinct as soon as they evolved if not for the ability of blood clotting. The first time you cut something and you started to bleed and you had no blood clotting, you'd bleed to death. So, you see, these things all point us to a conclusion here, and I like the way that this particular author put it together. He says, one does not get a poem without a poet or a law without a lawgiver. One does not get a painting without a painter or a musical score without a composer. And just as surely one does not get purposeful design without a designer. The design inherent in the universe is evident from the macrocosm to the microcosm and is sufficient to draw the conclusion demanded by the evidence in keeping with the law of rationality. God does exist. And this is a quote from, actually he's a brother in Christ named Bert Thompson, who writes on these subjects of apologetics. I see our time is pretty much gone. Anybody have a comment to make as we draw to close this morning? Okay. Thank you so much for your attention. I appreciate your attention to the class this morning. Thanks again.